You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey everyone, Chris Lopez here, and welcome back to another podcast episode. So today is going to be a little bit different than we talk about a lot of times when it comes to talking directly about real estate investing here in Denver. Rather, I got a special guest for this episode and the next episode. We're actually going to talk about Roth IRAs. And so we're going to do a two-part series on here, where this first part, today's episode, is going to be just about what a Roth IRA is, because it's often misunderstood and a lot of times like the younger stepchild to 401ks and traditional IRAs. But there's a lot of really cool thing about Roths. I've become very fascinated myself recently. So we're going to dive into just what the Roths are, where it fits into all types of retirement planning. And then the next episode will be the second part. Use Roths to go out there and invest in real estate. But before we can talk about how to use a Roth to invest in real estate, we got to understand the basics and build the foundation for it. So my special guest today is Will Duffy, and he is a financial planner here in the Denver area. His office is down on Lone Tree. And so Will has actually got two designations that's worth noting. The first is a chartered financial consultant. You might see those letters as CHFC. And the second is RICP, which is Retirement Income Certified Professional. And a good way to think about this is the chartered financial consultant is for helping people accumulate the wealth and the assets. And then the RICP is how to distribute it, so to make sure you can enjoy retirement and not run out of money before you die. So, Will, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to come record these today.
Hey, Chris, excited to be here to talk about Roths, one of my favorite topics.
And I mean, let's just jump into it, because I know you guys can't see it while I'm holding it. I'm holding my hands right now, but actually a book that the second edition will publish recently called Roths for the Rich. And it actually goes through a lot of detailed planning on here about what you need to know for Roth IRAs. So, Will, why'd you get into Roths?
Yeah, great question. The backstory is actually pretty fascinating. So a few years ago, I had a real estate deal personally. And this was one of those real estate deals where everything went right. We're talking bought at the bottom of the market, historically low interest rates on the financing, cash flowed perfectly, and then exited at the right time. And I was
great.
Yeah, that's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
And so I was crunching numbers because I love numbers. I'm fascinated by numbers. And I wanted to know what my IRR was. I wanted to know what my internal rate of return was on that particular real estate deal. And when I got done calculating it, I realized it was 30%. 30.
Mm-hmm.
And I got excited, but my excitement was quickly abated by the fact that I realized, wait a minute, I'm going to have to pay taxes.
So that's 30% IRR pre-tax.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so,
and actually, so IRR is a very complex metric. Give the listeners a 30-second rundown on what it is.
Yeah. So internal rate of return takes into consideration essentially time, and it takes into consideration inflows and outflows at specific periods of time. So a lot of returns that people are familiar with, such as annualized return or something known as compound annual growth rate, is really just looking at how much did you have at the beginning and how much do you have at the end. IRR is really the most complicated formula you can get to, which it actually looks at when did monies come in and when did monies go out.
And it takes into consideration the time value of money. And it's a phenomenal way to look at it. Google it for more details, because it is an advanced thing you have to use a spreadsheet or calculator for. So you had 30% IRR pre-tax, and then what was it post-tax?
Well, I didn't calculate the post-tax because I didn't want to be depressed. But that was a turning point in my life, because I realized for the first time how significant the tax bite is, and I needed to look for ways to reduce the tax bite. So I started researching tax strategies, and I wanted to figure out not only for that deal, which was water under the bridge, it's in the past, but future investments, future real estate deals, et cetera, is there anything I can do to either reduce or even eliminate taxation? And the one thing that kept coming up was Roth. And I wanted to dismiss it because I believed what still today a lot of people believe on Roths, which is this. Number one, if you make too much money, you can't contribute to a Roth. And two, the limits are so small, it's not really worth the time. And so I kept coming back to Roth, and I finally decided that if those two things were not true, this really was the way to go. And I want to pause for a second and give an analogy, a word picture, if you will, to help people, because when people hear the word Roth, in my experience, one of three things happens. And if one of these three things happens, they immediately kind of just close off to hearing anymore. And those three things are this. Number one, that if you make too much money, it's not for you. Okay, I'm here to say today that's false.
So the traditional income phase out, there's ways around it.
Absolutely. Absolutely ways around it. Number two is that we're talking about small amounts of money. That's also not true. There have been significant law changes since we got the original Roth IRA that now enable people to put in well over $50,000 a year. If they're married, you can double that. So we're talking about significant amounts of money. And then number three, this one's fascinating. People immediately hear Roth and affiliate it with the stock market. And that is also not accurate. Like you said, we're going to be talking about real estate in a Roth. But first, we got to lay the groundwork and we got to cover the Roth. So a Roth and the stock market really have nothing to do with one another. That is coming from the fact that a majority of people who have Roths are invested in the market. But the reality is you can put almost any investment into a Roth, into a traditional IRA, et cetera. So those are the three myths that I want to dispel right off the bat. The word picture I have is an umbrella. So take any investment, take any traditional investment, and if you can somehow get the Roth umbrella over that investment, you are now protecting it from taxation. It's a wrapper, so to speak. The Roth essentially prevents gains from being taxed. That's how it works. And so if you can get an investment into a Roth, which we're going to talk about how to do that, you are now protecting it from taxation. And the protection from taxation could be cash flows, it could be appreciation, it could be anything.
Gotcha. Now, before we jump down more on the Roths, and I hope I'm not skipping ahead here as we talk about this, but the first thing came to my mind as you were, you know, taking your tax hit on your great deal, why did you rule out a 1031 exchange, or did you rule out a 1031 exchange?
Yeah, that's a great question. So,
because that's what we talk about all the time, you know?
Of course. The particular real estate deal that I did, unfortunately, was heavily taxed with ordinary income versus capital gains.
Okay.
And in this particular deal, a 1031 exchange was not an option. But okay, Let's talk about it for people that are interested. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying that people should stop investing in real estate via traditional methods. You have to. There's only so much money you can get into a Roth. But what you're going to find is that the more you can get into Roth, you're really going to appreciate it because of two things. Number one, the cash flows from real estate, if they're inside of a Roth, are not going to be taxed.
Yep.
And the 1031 exchange is really an appreciation play. It's really to avoid the capital gains tax on the sale.
Yes.
And then number two, you can sell at a gain and rebuy without going through the process of a 1031 exchange and not pay the capital gains tax. The Roth essentially gives you the 1031 exchange benefit without all of the red tape, so to speak. Finding an address in 45 days, closing within 180 days, making sure it's like kind, et cetera.
Yep.
So there you go, in a nutshell.
Cool. So I've got like 30 more questions on that, but I think I might save that for episode number two.
All right. Love it.
So, okay, that's perfect. So where do you even start? Because I know you talk to probably hundreds of people a month about Roth. Where do we start on to, hey, what a Roth is and start building this foundation?
Yeah, great question. So in my research to try to figure out if a Roth should be an important part of my portfolio and to help me not pay taxes on investment gains going forward, I dug into the history of the Roth. And the history actually contains some nuggets of wisdom, so to speak, in understanding how it even came about. So I'd like to start with the history, if you're okay.
No,
with
that. That's a great place to start.
So the Roth actually goes all the way back to 1989. Now, it wasn't called a Roth then, but this is really the conception of the Roth. And there were two senators. One was Bob Packwood, and the other one was William Roth. And so I think you see where this is going. This is named after him. And in 1989, they proposed the idea of something called an IRA Plus. And the IRA Plus that they were proposing was something where you actually paid taxes on the front end, but received tax-free growth on the back end. It was the exact opposite of the IRA that existed at the time, which we got in 1974. So 15 years, we had had this traditional IRA. And they said, we want to have an IRA Plus, which is different. Instead of getting a tax deduction on the front end and paying taxes later, we won't get the tax deduction on the front end and we won't pay taxes later. Now, they didn't get what they wanted in 1989. And let's talk about why. And let's talk about why they're proposing this in 1989. When you look at the history of the income tax, which I cover extensively in my book and graphs and charts and everything, taxes came down under President Ronald Reagan. Today, we call them the Reagan tax cuts. And they came down to the lowest level in 1988. And so from a big picture standpoint, the reason people were deferring tax in traditional IRAs was because taxes were so high. Now, 1988, taxes have come back down. The top bracket was 28%.
What was, back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, what were the top income brackets then?
Great question. A lot of people have a hard time believing this, but tax brackets were in the 70%, 80%, even 90%. It topped out in 1944 with a top bracket of 94%, and that was on incomes of $200,000 or more. And so we have had historically high tax times in the past, and the reality was the government needed money. They needed money for the wars that they were involved in and that they had to pay for, promises they had made, et cetera. And there's no reason to think that we may not have higher taxes in the future. In fact, taxes are already scheduled on the calendar to increase 12/31 of 2025, which is when the current tax landscape, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, essentially sunsets. And so fast forward now to 1988, taxes have come down drastically. The top bracket is 28%. And that is why Senators Packwood and Roth had this idea of, wait a minute, with taxes so low, we don't want to defer this tax to the future when taxes may be higher, which ended up happening. So they came up with this idea of the IRA Plus. Well, the government pushed back. They didn't get enough people on board because they realized, wait a minute, this is actually a really good deal for the American people. Well, the good news is that they were persistent and they worked on this for 8 years. And finally, in 1997, they got what they wanted. And we got the Roth IRA from the Taxpayer Relief Act of 1997. And it was named after Senator William Roth. And that is really the birth of what we have today. And it's phenomenal how much has changed since 1997. And unfortunately, people today, CPAs, financial advisors, your average American worker is still stuck in what happened in 1997, which was this. Senator Roth was interviewed back in 1997, and he was excited that he got this Roth IRA passed. What he didn't like is that the White House told him, they forced him to put income limitations on this because they said, if we don't, you'll be helping the rich. And so he didn't like it, but as is common in government legislation, there's got to be some compromise. Mm-hmm. And so back in 1997, there were super low income limitations for if you made a certain amount of money, you could not have this new Roth IRA. And there was really low contribution limits. It was around $2,000. And so because that's how it was back then, it's really kind of stayed in everyone's minds that it's still the same today. And as we're going to cover today, everything's changed. The game has completely changed.
So that is a great like perspective to get the historical context because I think very few people realize that, hey, taxes used to be super high. And I mean, my personal bet when I kind of do my own financial planning and retirement planning is that two things will happen in the future. You know, hopefully my income will go up, so therefore I'm in a higher tax bracket, which is a great problem to have and one I want to have. And secondly, if I have to bet you $20 right now, I'm going to bet that taxes will go higher rather than lower because that's what things usually happen. And so it's really good for people to understand, as you said, because there's a really, really good chance taxes will go up. Now, before we move on, I got a totally non-important question here for you, but one that's always made me stumble. Why is Roth sometimes all capital letters and sometimes it's not? Is there a proper way to say it? Like sometimes R-O-T-H, all capital versus R-O-T-H? I know it's this kind of a silly question. I've always been curious about this.
So it's a fascinating question, and I don't know the exact answer, but I'm going to give you my take. I'm going to give you my opinion.
Good.
So IRA is always in all caps.
Yes.
And so what I think happened with the Roth IRA is some people said, well, let's just capitalize all of them because we're used to doing that with Roth. I choose not to do that, and I essentially just use a capital R like William Roth's last name.
Okay, cool. All right, so going forward on here, and you can correct me on these numbers here, but I think what the contribution limits now are 5,500 if you're 55 and under?
Yeah, so
you tell us that way I get it. We get it right from the get-go.
Yeah,
give us the contribution limits, the income limits, all that stuff.
Okay, will do. So the contribution limits were just increased this year for the first time in a very long time. So it's actually 6,000 now. And I want to make sure I'm being clear for the audience. I'm talking about the Roth IRA. One of the things that excites me, which we're going to get to next, is the Roth 401k.
Yes.
So the limits on the Roth IRA are 6,000. And that is if you're under the age of 50. But in the year that you turn 50, there's a catch-up contribution of $1,000, bringing your total contribution to 7,000. And this is fascinating. If you're married, even if your spouse does not work, they can piggyback on your income and do the same 6,000 or 7,000 if they're 50 or older. So a perfect example is my wife is a homemaker. We've got four little kids at home that she's taking care of. And we max fund her Roth IRA each year with 6,000 using my income, even though she doesn't have any.
So even though she has no W-2 earned income, you still do that.
Correct.
And that's a recent change?
No,
that's always been like that.
That's been that way. But that's a fascinating thing that a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
And it helps us get to bigger numbers sooner, which is what we're trying to do. Now, let's talk about the income limitations. This depends if you file a single tax return or if you're filing married filing jointly. Single tax return, as soon as you hit $122,000 of income, it begins what's known as the Roth phase out. And so that 6,000 gets reduced. As soon as you hit 137,000, again, single tax return, you're completely phased out. And on the married filing jointly side, it begins at 193,000 and is completely phased out at 203,000. So if you're listening right now and you fall within these income limits, I want you to realize the title of my book is Roth for the Rich. This book was written for you. This advice that I have is for you because there is a way around it, these income limitations, and the way around it has been controversial for years. There have been attorneys on both sides of the fence arguing if the way around it is legal or not. I took the stance in my book that it's completely fine. It's legal, it's doable, et cetera. And we'll get to this soon, but the most recent tax reform, which happened under President Trump, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, contained explicit stamp of approval on this strategy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So what we're doing is completely fine, and they put their stamp of approval on it.
Okay. So keep talking on these points because I'm running down a list of questions.
Absolutely.
And I don't want to go down a rabbit's hole before we get all the foundation built up.
Yeah. So let's fast forward in time. 1997, we get the Roth IRA. There's really low contribution limits. There's really low, way lower than today, income limitations. Let's fast forward to 2001. This is one of the most significant legislative changes in the history of the Roth. We get a law in 2001 that everybody in my world calls EGTRA. And what it stands for is the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act. This law gave us the Roth 401k. Now, I'm going to tell you a little interesting tidbit in history. Even though this law was passed in 2001, the Roth portion of the law would not go into effect until 2006. Now, I can't say if that was intentional or not, but it had unintended consequences, which was this. I'm guessing in 2001, I was still in high school. I'm guessing that this made a lot of ripples throughout the country. Like, wow, we now have a Roth 401k option. Completely different rules in the Roth IRA. Different amounts, mm-hmm. no income limitations, et cetera. But the problem is it didn't go into effect until 2006. After 5 years, even after a shorter amount of time, everybody's going to forget this excitement. And that's exactly what happened. Even though we're in 2019 and we've had a Roth 401k option for 13 years, I still find that most people, A, don't know about it. Most plans don't have it, meaning most 401k plans don't have the option. And the plans that do, the participants are not taking advantage of it. This is stunning to me that we've had such a cool opportunity for so long and people are not taking advantage of it. And again, I think it's founded and rooted in two things. One, people still think that what was true in 1997 is still true. And two, this was passed in 01, but didn't take effect until 2006. And by then everybody forgot about it.
Okay.
Now, let's talk about this Roth 401k for a second. This option is significant because the limits for how much you can put into an IRA and the limits for how much you can put into a 401k plan, again, it doesn't matter if it's traditional or Roth, are found in different sections of the tax code. And the section that contains the limits for a 401k plan for what's called the elective deferral are found in tax code section 402 part G. And those limits, as a lot of people in your audience are probably familiar with, are much higher than the IRA side. So the limits are this year are $19,000. So compare that to $6,000. And the catch up, if you're 50 or older, is $6,000. Compare that to $1,000 on the IRA side. You have the ability in a 401k plan to put anywhere from $19,000 to $25,000 of what's known as an elective deferral each year. And starting in 2006, you can put that into Roth. And here's the best part. There's no income limitations in the Roth 401k. You could make $100,000, you could make $1 million. It doesn't matter. There's nothing to get around because there are no income limitations.
Now, do a lot of, because you know, most people with 401ks, your stereotype one is a W-2 person at a small business or a big corporation. Is it common for these 401k plans to offer a Roth version?
So great question. And it reminds me of something that I need to say because it's very important. A 401k plan by default has to be a traditional 401k. When I say traditional 401k, I mean the same as a traditional IRA, where you get a tax deduction on the front end, you defer your tax to a later date and you pay it later. Now, starting in 2006, what this EGTRA law allowed was to add an additional option in the plan known as a designated Roth option. And so this would, you can never take away the traditional side, but plans can now add the Roth side. And to answer your question, yes, it's still not utilized enough. There's actually no reason that every single 401k plan should not have this Roth option, but still a lot of them don't. And getting it in there is only half the battle. Now we need to make people aware of it so that they can utilize it and know there are no income limitations.
Right. Okay. So, and if I'm jumping ahead here, you can tell me, but you know, a question always pops up is, well, is it better to get the tax deferral today? Because hey, let's say I put in, for easy number, let's say I put $10,000 away this year. and I get to write off about 30% between federal and state, easy numbers. Hey, great, my $3,000 tax deduction. Now, when that grows over the next 30, 40, 50 years, I take it out, I'll pay taxes then. Generally speaking, is it better to pay taxes now to like a Roth IRA contribution or to a Roth account or defer the taxes? What's going to give me a greater chunk of money down the road? I'm sure there's probably 100 variables in here, but like, you know, using some basic assumptions for, you know, I'll say a younger person not near retirement and a, you know, moderate to higher risk investing profile.
Yeah, great question. And so what you've asked is the $1 million question.
And it literally probably is a $1 million question, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And there's no easy answer. And so I want to come at this from a little bit different vantage point than most people you will listen to, you will read, et cetera. Most people look at this question and they look at it as, where are they personally in life? Where is their income? What tax bracket are they in? How old are they? How close are they to retirement? And I want to argue today that that is of the least importance. In my opinion, what's of the most importance is where we are at from a tax perspective in the country. Instead of looking at whether you're in a high tax bracket or a low tax bracket, let's look at what tax brackets are generally in the country. And when we look at this, we find that taxes today are historically low. They're not only historically low, they're some of the lowest taxes that we've had in history. And so looking at this from a kind of a macro scale and looking at this from not our individual tax brackets, but the tax brackets themselves, I think what you'll see is it's probably better to pay tax today on the seed, as I like to say, and not on the harvest. Remember my umbrella analogy?
Yep.
From a traditional IRA standpoint or a traditional 401k standpoint, imagine turning the umbrella upside down. That is what that is. Now, you're not protecting yourself from taxes. You're actually accumulating taxes. That umbrella is going to fill up with water. And these traditional accounts actually accumulate taxes because the taxes are deferred. And so the better your investments do, the more tax you're going to have. And so I like to ask people a lot, and you touched on this a little bit in your own personal scenario, is I like to ask people this: do you want investments that become worth less the more successful you become?
No. I mean, it's the same reason why my plan is to keep 1031 property so I can defer taxes until I die.
Absolutely.
Same concept. Yeah. I mean, I absolutely want to minimize it.
And no one ever answers yes to that. And the reality is that that is what a traditional IRA or a traditional 401k is doing for you, is it's making your investments worth less the more successful you become, because the more successful you become, the higher your income, the higher your tax bracket. And when you pull that money out, that's going to go on top of whatever tax bracket you happen to be in.
And then we stack that on top of there's a good chance taxes will be higher in the future at the federal level, probably at the state level too, and it's the double whammy.
Absolutely. And we'll get into this later, but I want to make sure that the audience knows we're going to talk about this. There's a huge hidden benefit to Roth that is not, that you do not get with a traditional IRA or traditional 401k. And that is this: a Roth IRA does not have what's known as required minimum distributions, RMDs. And what I found in working with clients that are of that age, which is 70 and a half, there's actually legislation right now in Congress to change that. But as it stands today, it's 70 and a half. And A, they don't like the RMDs. B, I show in the book mathematically why RMDs actually hurt you over the long haul. And C, in the next episode, we're going to talk heavily about real estate in a Roth. You really want to avoid RMDs with real estate. So we'll get to that. But just want everybody to know we will talk about that.
Let's go and talk about RMDs, because that's a really important thing to look about. And that's really, you know, hey, we're at the point where you're distributing the capital you built up over a lifetime. What are RMDs and why do they matter?
Yeah, so RMDs stand for required minimum distribution. And essentially, when we first got the IRA back in 1974, the government realized, hey, you know, similar to your 1031 example, the government realized, hey, there might be people who defer this tax until they die. Now, the 1031 option of deferring until you die still exists. Some people refer to that as the last free lunch in the tax code. But you can't do that with an IRA. So they thought about that and they said, we're going to eliminate that. So that's why we have RMDs. So essentially, when you turn 70 and a half, any money that you have in a traditional IRA, there is a required, by the government, minimum, they set how much it is, distribution, you have to take the money out. And those RMDs go up every single year for the rest of your life.
Because it's like a percentage, right?
It is. It's essentially a complicated formula based on average life expectancy. But anyway, what's fascinating to me is this. Number one, everybody knows the benefit of tax deferral, right? A 1031 exchange is a great example of a benefit of tax deferral. If you defer the tax, you have more money, and so you can keep building your nest egg. Well, the RMD stops your tax deferral. When you take the money out of the IRA, you are now, you can't put the money back in. So you've essentially lost that snowball effect of tax deferral. Number two, you have to pay the tax when you take it out. So when you pay the tax, you now have less money. And number three, if you want to theoretically reinvest that money, you're going to have a hard time putting it into something like a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA because you can't. That money is not considered income and you can't put it into those vehicles. So you're going to be putting it into something that most likely has a tax consequence to it.
Like just a standard brokerage account.
Exactly. And so these RMDs are significant. And what's scary to me is this, is that the government gets to decide how much you have to take out, what that factor is each year. And they get to decide what the tax rate is. So they have full control as to how much you have to take out, how much they're going to require, and how much you're going to have to pay taxes on. And I don't know about you, but I like being in control. And so losing control on two things that are that significant are not appealing, which is a huge benefit of Roth. And I want to make one thing clear in case anybody really likes to get into the weeds. This is only true of a Roth IRA, not a Roth 401k. But you can, we'll talk about this shortly, you can roll a Roth 401k into a Roth IRA if you still happen to be working at 70 and a half to avoid having RMDs.
Great. So there's, as long as you kind of have that in your timeline, there's a way to avoid the RMDs for the Roth 401k.
Absolutely.
Good to know. So what other important stuff do we need to talk about for the Roth before you talk about how you get money in there?
Yeah. So let's talk about a couple more law changes.
Okay.
So the next big one, and this is interesting, the next big one happened in 2005. So try to wrap your mind around this. This happened before the 2001 law went into effect, before the Roth portion went into effect in 2006. So in 2005, we get a law called TIPRA. It stands for the Tax Increase Prevention and Reconciliation Act. This, in my opinion, is the single most important legislative change in the history of the Roth. What this did is this got rid of the income limitations on Roth conversions. So there was not only income limitations on Roth contributions, there were income limitations on Roth conversions.
A conversion?
Yeah, conversion is where you take traditional IRA money and you convert it to Roth IRA money. And so they, again, were smart and realized wealthy people who make too much money to contribute will just try to bypass it by doing a conversion. So they put income limitations on conversions. And I believe it was $100,000 of household income.
So not the amount in the account, but just what your income was.
Correct. So okay. It didn't matter what you had in your traditional IRA. If your household income was $100,000 or more, you could not convert your traditional money to Roth. And so in 2005, they passed a law saying we're going to get rid of those income limitations. Now anybody and everybody can convert to Roth. This really got the country excited. But yet again, that portion of the law would not go into effect until 2010.
So they kick the can down the road a few years.
Absolutely. And again,
Congress does.
That's what they do. And so again, a lot of people kind of forgot about this. We are now in a situation where for 9 years, anybody and everybody can do a Roth conversion from traditional IRA to Roth IRA. And it's phenomenal how many people I meet that should have been doing that and weren't doing that. And here's why. You can do a partial conversion. No one's saying you have to convert your entire nest egg in one shot. You can be very strategic about this and actually look at your income each year, which is what we do with our clients. In December, we look at what their income is and we figure out how much should we convert to Roth without bumping you into too high of a tax bracket.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. And so that right there, in my opinion, is the most significant legislative change in the history of the Roth. And it's not just because you can convert traditional IRA money to Roth, but it's because of some other things, which we'll get into in a second, where that conversion power is what enables people today to put very large sums of money into Roth each year. Couple more pieces of legislative change that I want to cover. The 2006 Pension Protection Act allowed someone to go directly from a 401k plan to a Roth. This sounds insignificant, but it actually was a good thing that they did, because what people were doing to try to get 401k money to Roth is they were having to go directly to an IRA and then convert the IRA to Roth. The problem is this law changed in 2006 and there were still income limitations on doing those conversions. So they could only get part way, not the whole way.
And you're talking about like, you know, if I have a job, my 401k, then I move, rolling my 401k into a traditional IRA, and then the second step is converting that traditional IRA into a Roth IRA.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that this law allowed you to skip that step.
So just go straight from a 401k to a Roth.
Yes. And again, you're going straight from a traditional 401k to a Roth. So what you're doing is you're doing the conversion, but you're skipping the step of going to a traditional IRA first and then converting the traditional IRA, which is important because remember, those income limitations didn't go away until 2010. And so this was a way to essentially avoid those income limitations. There's two more pieces of legislation that are important. In 2010, we got the Small Business Jobs Act. This allowed for partial Roth conversions inside of the 401k plan. Very significant. And then 2012, we have the American Taxpayer Relief Act, which allowed full-blown Roth conversions inside of the 401k plan. Let me tell you why this is so important. To get money out of a 401k plan is really not easy. Mm. You essentially have to quit or die. And so nobody really wants to do that. I guess I could add retire to that. Essentially end your employment or pass away. And so for a lot of people, that means they're going to have to wait until 59 and a half or older. And so the ability to do a Roth conversion inside of a 401k plan means if you're in your 30s or 40s or 50s for that matter, and your plan allows this, you can actually do Roth conversions inside of the plan while you're working.
I have not heard of that.
Phenomenal. So the government calls this an in-plan rollover. I hate the term, but I want to give you the legal term in case anybody wants to look it up. The reason I don't like the term is because people affiliate the word rollover with money coming out of a plan and going into an IRA.
Yep.
So I call it an in-plan conversion. That to me just is easy for people to understand.
And so this would basically, make sure I understand this. So if I've, you know, got, I'm just, you know, a participant in whatever 401k plan and they have the option selected to allow a Roth 401k, I can convert my traditional 401k money, some or all of it, over to the Roth version. Kind of whenever I want to.
Exactly. You got it.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And so that allows people that have significant balances that they've accumulated over the years to start doing strategic Roth conversions now inside of their plan. And by the way, I would guess, and this guess is going to be very educated and probably close to accurate, that 95% of 401k plans in existence today don't allow this, even though they can. So starting in 2012, the government gave every single 401k plan the ability to do this. And today, 95% of plans don't allow it. And so what I've done is I have worked with my business owner clients on changing their company's plans. And when I have clients who work for companies, we've worked with their company to change the plan to allow this option.
I'm really curious because do you have good luck with just calling up a 401k administrator and getting them to add it or change it? It's got to be an uphill battle.
It's an absolute uphill battle. Nobody likes to make changes. You know the saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And it's absolutely an uphill battle. Where I have the most luck is when I'm dealing with the business owner directly, yeah. because they can, you know, pull the levers and make the decisions. And it's just a no-brainer. It's an absolute no-brainer.
Okay, so that happened in 2012?
2012 is when we got full unencumbered Roth conversions inside of 401k plans.
Okay, and actually went to effect that year, not 5
Correct.
Years down the road?
That one went into effect that year.
Okay. Any other legislation?
The only thing is I mentioned earlier, which I'll just mention again, which is the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which, by the way, was the most significant tax reform in history. And it actually plays into this more than the fact that we got the IRS's stamp of approval on how to get around the income limitations, is that it lowered taxes. So it lowered the tax brackets, but it also lowered the thresholds. I said that wrong. It actually raised the thresholds, which has the effect of lowering your taxes.
I'm not following.
Yeah, let me explain what I mean. So we have these different tax brackets, which have a tax percentage attached to each one.
Uh-huh.
If the government lowers the thresholds for each bracket, it's actually could be looked at as a tax increase because more people now hit those brackets. But this actually had a double positive effect, which is it lowered the brackets. For example, the top bracket went from 39.6% down to 37%, but the thresholds it actually raised. So instead of making 400 some thousand to be in the top bracket, you now have to make 600,000 to be in the top bracket. When you combine those two things, higher thresholds and lower brackets, you actually have a double positive tax effect going on.
You know, I never thought about that with the thresholds.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And it's why I'm telling people now we have a political window of opportunity that we have not had a window of opportunity like this in the history of the Roth. If you want to go back to find taxes as low as they are today, you'd really have to go back to 1988 to 1991. Era. Well, we didn't get the Roth until 1997. So this is the most perfect time to not only be utilizing Roth, but also to be making conversions to Roth.
So are there any, let's say I've got 401ks, I've got my traditional IRAs. What are the downsides of, say, great, I'm going to convert everything right now to a Roth IRA because I get no RMDs when I turn 70 and a half. I should probably walk away with more money at the end of the day, have more control, more flexibility. Are there any downsides for like the long-term planning on the distribution side of not having stuff in traditional tax-deferred vehicles?
So I think you asked two questions there, and I want to answer both. There could be a downside to converting everything in one shot. And some people do that. And what they're doing is they are actually preventing future legislation risk. What I mean by that is the people that decide they want to convert all in one shot. Famous phrase that I can give. It's better to deal with the devil you know than the devil you don't.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to make sure that they know what the tax rate is. They want to pay it. And if taxes happen to change next year, let's say, you know, Trump is not reelected and they're able to undo this relatively quickly, they're eliminating that risk. What I tell people is this: there's definitely potential ramifications to doing this too fast, which is taxes don't go up next year. And if you would have spread it out over 2 to 3 years, you would have paid less taxes.
Yeah, because if I take it all at once, I'm going to probably bump up the higher tax bracket.
You got it. And there's definitely a risk to doing this too slow, which is, oops, now taxes go up and you're going to have to convert at those rates. So there is a happy medium there. And for me, what we do is we just essentially look at someone's situation and figure out, based on their income, based on what they project their future income will be, et cetera, how to do this over the right happy medium amount of time, which is usually, I'd say, 3 to 5 years.
Okay. Now, what about on the, you know, 30, 40 years down the road, I am in retirement.
Yes. Yes.
What are the downsides there, or if there are any? Because that's what I'm really curious about. Because I read your book last week, and then it just got me thinking about that.
So I don't see any downsides, and here's why. When we start talking about down the road, this becomes a very fascinating discussion. So number one, by doing Roth, we are essentially, for all intents and purposes, eliminating tax risk in the future. So that's something you have on the traditional side. Again, we don't know what they're going to be, but you're at least eliminating the risk that if they do go up, you won't be affected. The second thing is we're eliminating RMDs. For people that want to accumulate wealth, for people that want to have real estate, you don't want to have RMDs. RMDs with real estate are very difficult. It essentially eats into your cash flow once you're in retirement because... Well,
could trigger you have to sell the house
it,
too.
It absolutely could trigger having to sell the house. Plus, for people that are trying to leave a legacy, it's gonna hurt your compounding. So it eliminates that as well. And then let me talk about this as well, because for a lot of people this is important to them. Social Security, which some people start at 62 and anywhere in between, all the way up till age 70. Social Security is not tax-free anymore. That changed back in 1983. And the formula for how much of your Social Security benefit is taxed includes traditional IRA income. It does not include Roth income. Let that sink in for a minute. You could have $100,000 a year of Roth retirement income and have none of your Social Security be taxed, because the Roth income is not in the formula for how much they tax Social Security.
Wow.
But the traditional IRA income does. And today, with very little income, you can actually have 85% of your Social Security benefit that is taxable at whatever your marginal rate is. So the benefits on the distribution side are staggering when it comes to Roth.
Yeah, because I was, like I said, you kind of got my gears turning when I read this last week. I was like, I don't see any downsides for converting everything like long term on the distribution side. And I was really curious, like, so there's no significant red flags.
No. And I want to say one other thing, just in case anybody in your audience, if this is applicable to, met with some clients recently and they are retiring. They're 65. And so they started looking into Medicare. What they didn't realize was that all the money they've been putting into Medicare, which is our FICA taxes, our self-employment taxes, that pays for Part A trust fund for Medicare. It doesn't pay for Part B. Part B has a premium, and that premium has a formula. They were shocked to find out. They thought they were going to be paying $136 a month each in retirement for Medicare Part B. Well, now they're going to pay $921 a month.
Ooh, each?
Total. And those numbers, by the way, go up every year because Medicare is completely broke, just like Social Security is broke. And the answer to these problems, unfortunately, is taxes from the government. Well, guess what? Roth income doesn't go into those formulas either. So with proper planning, you can keep all of your Social Security, which I think you should. It's your money. You put it there. You were promised it back. And B, reduce your Medicare costs in retirement. Very significant.
Did not know that either. Okay, so you're getting, okay, so Roths are sounding much, much more attractive.
Great. So let's talk about, with our remaining time, how to really maximize this. And I want to just let everybody know, I give a lot of warnings in my book to not try this at home. And I think that's important. You want to find somebody who's competent to help you with this, because as with all complicated things, things can go wrong. And you definitely don't want this to go wrong. So let's talk about how to get around the income limitations of the Roth IRA. If your income happens to be too high, you can still contribute to a traditional IRA.
So for this example, let's just say, me and my wife are married and we make $300,000 a year.
Perfect.
We're above the Roth contribution limit.
Yep.
This would apply then.
This would apply.
Okay.
So nothing is going to stop you from contributing to a traditional IRA. It's the same numbers. So 6,000 and 7,000 if you're 50 or older. Now, I don't want to get into this because it's too much in the weeds, but the deductibility of that matters. You can lose the deductibility of that traditional IRA based on whether or not you or your spouse is covered by a 401k plan, but it's irrelevant. No matter what, you can take that traditional IRA, whether it's a deductible IRA or a non-deductible IRA, and you can convert that to Roth because of TIPRA in 2005. which went into effect in 2010. Now, this is a strategy that I did not come up with. This is known as the backdoor Roth.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, it's a way to get around the income limitations. It's just paperwork and one extra step. It's absolutely worth it. I look back now at the amount of years that I could have done this for my wife and I still lose a little sleep over it because I can never get those years back. So this is a way for married couples out there to get $12,000 to $14,000 into Roth every year, no matter how high your income. And if you're not married, $6,000 to $7,000 into Roth, no matter how high your income. And the exciting part about this is that this is probably the weakest strategy that I have in my book.
Okay.
So,
but you're still limited by those $6,000, $7,000 contribution limits.
You are. So if you want to do more than this, that's when we need to start looking into better ways to do that. And so the first one, and by the way, the limits that we're going to be talking about now are in addition to the $6,000. So you want, in my opinion, you want to do the $6,000 each year because it's just more money you can get in. So let's talk about the 401k plan. If you don't have a 401k plan and you're listening, fear not. There's a solution to that. But let's start by talking about the 401k plan. If you have access to a 401k plan or you don't have one and you want to know how to get one, this will allow you very quickly to start getting tens of thousands into Roth each year. As I mentioned before, the elective deferral limit, the 402g limit, is $19,000 and it's $25,000 if you're 50 or older. And this would be per person. Now, this is a situation where your wife would actually have to be working as well because this is coming out of payroll. But this is a quick way to get anywhere between $38,000 and $50,000 a year into Roth is by utilizing a 401k plan. Now, if your company that you work for doesn't have a 401k plan, it might be because they don't know about what we're talking about. They might think it's just some traditional 401k plan that they're really not interested in. But when they realize we can have a Roth option, that might get them excited. If you're self-employed and you don't have a 401k plan, there are self-employed 401k plans. I have one. I set them up for my clients all the time. All we have to do is set this up, which has very minimal cost, to now give you the ability to put this amount of money into the plan each year.
And you guys can't see it out there, but I'm nodding my head because I've set up a couple of years different businesses and they are just phenomenal plans for small business owners. Like you get some pretty amazing benefits and you can stash away a lot of money.
Absolutely. Let's talk about a SEP IRA for a second. So a SEP IRA stands for a Simplified Employee Pension Plan. And a lot of people listening who are self-employed are probably familiar with a SEP IRA. Maybe you've looked at one, maybe you've considered one, maybe you even have one. A SEP IRA is actually a gateway to Roth. And a lot of people miss this because there is no Roth SEP. So you have a traditional IRA and you have its counterpart, the Roth IRA. You have a traditional 401k and on the other side, you have a Roth 401k. You don't have a Roth SEP. What people have forgotten is that a SEP IRA, even though it's technically an employer plan, it's also an IRA, which means you can convert it to Roth. And so a SEP plan is actually a great way to get money into Roth. You set up the SEP plan, you fund it, and you immediately, if you want, convert it to Roth. And so there's a lot of companies out there, especially self-employed individuals that have SEP IRAs and don't realize they have a lot of money sitting there that they can start converting, and they can convert it now going forward on an annual basis.
Gotcha. I got some questions about this, but I'm gonna save them for you.
And I do want to mention that the SEP limit for contributions is $56,000 this year. $56,000 per person can go into a SEP. So I have clients who actually max fund their SEP every year, which would be $56,000 this year, and immediately convert it to Roth. Now we're talking about getting to six figures in a Roth in 1 to 2 years. Hopefully I have everyone's attention.
Yeah.
Lastly, I want to talk about what's known as after tax. And this is a very not well-known and almost never utilized part of a 401k plan. And I also want to say this. a lot of people, a lot of articles online, even the 401k plan documents themselves often refer to Roth as after tax, and that's technically not accurate. So I'm on this mission, which is I'm probably just spinning my wheels, but I'm trying to get everybody to use the same language and refer to Roth as post-tax. So everybody understands pre-tax. That's what we've had for so many years.
That's an uphill battle.
Yes, it is. You got
it. I admire it.
And so Roth is post-tax, which means you're paying taxes and then you're investing it. After tax is its own unique thing that you can have inside of a 401k plan, which allows you to put in way more than $19,000. You can go all the way up to $62,000 with after tax if you're 50 or older, and up to $56,000 if you're under 50, and you can put it into after tax. Now, when I explain what after tax contributions are to people in a 401k plan, they immediately want nothing to do with them. It sounds like the worst investment known to man. After tax means you pay taxes on the money, and then the money grows tax deferred. There's no benefit. You don't get a benefit on the front end. You don't get a benefit on the back end. That's why nobody does it. That's why plans don't include it. Remember, I talked about the American Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012 and the Pension Protection Act of 2006. Guess what? Both of those laws allow you to convert after-tax money to Roth.
So I can fund it.
Yes.
And then the next day, convert it.
Absolutely.
And that way it's after tax dollars now, but then I'll get the benefit of 30 years down the road, tax free.
Correct. Look at it as a direct pathway to funding, max funding a Roth. And again, do exactly like you just said, put the money in and make sure you convert it before you have any gains and you're home free.
And this is something that only business owners can do, or can just participants in employers' 401k plans do as well, or does it depend?
Well, what I'm talking about specifically applies to 401k plans.
Okay.
So this would have to be something in your 401k plan with your employer, or something that we set up if you're a business owner.
Gotcha. So do you have a favorite strategy, or does it just depend on the situation?
It really depends on the situation. But I would say if I had to pick, my favorite strategy is the 401k plan. And what I'm really excited to talk about in the next episode is how to do real estate in your 401k plan. And so to really narrow down my true favorite, that's probably what it is.
Okay. I'm excited to talk about that too, because I love Roth just for general investing for all the reasons we talked about. You know, it's one of the best places to park money. And I've never been a fan of self-directed IRAs because all the rules and RMDs and that stuff. So I'm very interested to hear about that. So, all right, let me ask you a couple questions here. And I'll preface this. I'm just going to use myself as a very loose example. So I know this is not, you know, technically legal advice or whatever, or, you know, financial advice, but it'll help me wrap my head around and hopefully help some listeners, since I'm a pretty, you know, common thing. So, you know, I'm a real estate agent, so I'm self-employed. And I'm going to use that term loosely, whether I'm self-employed or have an S corporation or whatever. Just I'm self-employed. And all our listeners are as well. They're agents, or they're small business owners who invest, or they're just investors who are now reaping the benefits of all the real estate stuff. So you're talking to a self-employed person like me, where let's say I make a good income. Let's say I've got $100,000 net income, and that's money I don't need to use for living. That's money I've got free for investing. Because that's my goal. If I get that much money every year, I can go out there and do some damage when it comes to investing. So what would be some good strategies for me to start funneling some money into Roth? And I'm going to give you one more thing before I ask that question, because my mindset was basically I was just going to put, you know, $6,000 in my wife's IRA, my IRA, and also use an HSA account. And then beyond that, we weren't going to invest in 401ks because I'm not a big fan of the traditional stuff. Everything else just goes into real estate because of all their tax advantages and 1031s now. So I know I just gave you a lot of information there, but what are some good ways, or what would you start taking me through to kind of set up some good ways to start funneling money into Roth other than the $6,000 contribution for me and $6,000 for my wife?
Yeah, here's what I would say. Real estate agents that are self-employed are probably the best candidate for this.
Okay, good.
The ability for them to take the most advantage of these strategies is relatively simple. And so what I would tell you and what I've told countless people is we need to set up a 401k plan. And we need to set up a 401k plan, and we can do that, A, because you're self-employed, and B, we need to set that up so that you have access to these larger contribution limits. And setting it up is relatively painless, very, very low cost. And as soon as it's set up, you're free to start making maximum contributions into these plans.
And you're talking about like the solo 401k or individual 401k? Because I say that because as an agent, I don't have any employees.
Okay, great. Yeah. So if someone has employees, this is still absolutely doable. There's just one extra hurdle, which is figuring out how to make sure we meet the discrimination testing, top heavy testing, et cetera.
Yeah.
If you don't have employees, it's even easier. And so if you don't have employees, the government has a plan known as an individual 401k plan. That's what they call it. We like to call it on the street solo 401k plans or even solo K. And that is super easy because there is no discrimination testing. There is no top heavy testing. And so you can really just set it up and utilize it.
Okay. And I'm assuming from the get-go, set up so you got the Roth option, obviously.
You got it. Yeah. So the whole key to these strategies is setting up the plan right. I've had a lot of people, and it's fine, but they hear me speak at an event or hear me doing a podcast or a radio interview, and they rush out to try to do this. And here's what you're going to find. The institutions where you can set these plans up, you know, the Charles Schwabs and the Fidelities and the Merrill Lynches, they're not going to give you these options that we're talking about. They're probably not even going to give you a Roth option, interestingly enough. And the reason why is because they're trying to make sure that you utilize this with their products.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to go buy a rental property from Charles Schwab. And so the whole key is the plan design, because even though things are allowed, you can only do it in a 401k plan if the plan document allows it.
Which is, and that's what the trustee, right? You're saying, is that, am I like the Merrill Lynch, the Vanguard, whoever is like administering the account?
Yeah. So they're going to have a canned plan that they're going to give you, and you're stuck with that plan. And again, as far as I've seen, there's not even a Roth option in those plans.
Okay.
If you want flexibility in the plan design, meaning to get all of these benefits and features that I'm talking about, you need to work with somebody like myself that can give you that. And so when I create plans for clients, they're actually custom designed. We go through all of the options and pick the ones that we want and make sure it's all in there.
Cool. And I got more questions. We'll save that for the next episode though, because we'll kind of start bleeding into, because that structure is very important for buying real estate. So okay, a follow-up question on here. So I've set up a solo K, you know, in a previous business. I've not set up as an agent yet, just because my previous business was me and a partner, no employees, so we could do it. And refresh my memory and the listeners, because there's two sides to putting money in there. One's the deferring it as an employee, and then one is contributing it on the employer side, right?
Yes.
Do you remember what the breakdowns are? What do I need to do so I can maximize that? Like, what are the rules around that? Do you recall?
Yeah. So there are actually different ways of doing that.
Okay.
And I'm just going to give you a shortcut. Employer contributions to a 401k plan can never go into Roth.
They cannot.
Correct.
Oh.
And so that is eye-opening to people. So for example, when I meet with clients and explain this to them and they go switch their contribution to Roth, they find that their traditional side keeps growing. Well, that's because the employer contributions, whether it's a match, whether it's a, you know, profit sharing, whether it's a bonus at the end of the year, whatever, that can never go into Roth. And so what I'm going to suggest to you in your situation and to the listeners is the easiest thing to do is to max out your 402G contribution, which is the $19,000 if you're under 50.
That's for basically the employee side.
Yes. And put that directly into Roth.
Okay.
Then make an after-tax contribution, which is also the employee side, of whatever you want up to the limits, and then convert it to Roth. That's the best way. Just stay out of the employer side.
And because I guess really, even if I, you know, contribute, let's just say as the employer, end of the day, whether I'm contributing to the 401k as the employer or doing an after-tax one to maximize it, it kind of has the same tax consequences on me, and then or nothing too big?
Yeah, so the end result will be identical.
Okay, that's the better way
yep,
to say it.
Yep, the end result is going to be identical. And I've done this with CPAs, so that's all fine. And the amount will be the same. So what I do is I tell people, listen, this is the easiest path and it's the painless path, and your end result will be exactly the same. You're going to end up with the exact same amount of money in Roth and your tax bill is going to be the same.
Gotcha. Good. Because I've always been confused by that, but I'm just going to, because I know you did all the homework on there. So thank you.
You got it.
Cool. Well, I got a ton more questions. We'll save that for the real estate side of things. Any other things that we need to mention on here before we wrap up and record the next one?
I think this is a great foundation. And with this foundation, let's dive into more in-depth, specifically real estate.
Awesome. All right. So, Will, thank you. And then as we wrap up, what's a good way for people to get a hold of you to either help them out about this or learn more about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So my book is on Amazon. You can buy a physical copy or you can get a digital version on Kindle. The best way to find my book is to search Amazon for Roth IRA. It should be number one or number two. And then the website you can go to is rothsfortherich.com. rothsfortherich.com.
Awesome. And I'll put that in the show notes too so everyone has that. Awesome, Will. Thank you.
Thank you.